With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'll never forget a morning I went into the coronary care unit. It was a Sunday morning and I looked around at the male bay and I thought, gosh, they're quite young today. And I talked to them and they didn't really have many risk factors, but the key thing that they spoke about was having this period of stress that then led to this central crushing chest pain that brought them in. And it's so important now for us as a society really to think about how we can tackle this.
Welcome to the Doctor's Kitchen podcast with me, Dr. Rupi, where we discuss the most important topics and concepts in the medicinal qualities of food and lifestyle. Today, I'm speaking with Dr. Zoreen Morgan, who is a consultant cardiologist specialised in cardiac imaging, specifically advanced echocardiography and cardiac MRI, following her PhD in sleep at Imperial College London and the Royal Brompton Hospital. We'll be talking about her exciting new project called Fresh Hearts, where she's committed to tackling the root causes of cardiac disease, which aims to empower people to lead longer, healthier, happier lives. We'll be talking about her personal experience of lifestyle medicine, the cardiologist from America who inspired her journey, and a particular focus on things like atrial fibrillation and preventative cardiology, what that actually means. Make sure you listen to the end of the podcast where I'll be summarizing what we talked about and how you can get involved with her new project, the Fresh Hearts Project. I honestly think it's going to be game changing for the NHS, and I cannot wait to send people her way who want to look after their hearts more effectively using lifestyle alongside medicines. Like I always say, there is a lot of evidence-based, safe dietary and lifestyle change that we as practitioners can be confidently discussing with our patients, and that's what we're going to be chatting about today. So make sure you listen right to the end. Check out Dr. Zoreen Morgan and her website. I'm going to put all her socials on my podcast show notes. In the first part of this podcast with Dr. Zoreen, I made her some chai spiced overnight oats with dried pears, some berries, and some quality fats. If you want to see the recipe, then check it out on YouTube at thedoctorskitchen.com. And you can also see it on my podcast show notes at thedoctorskitchen.com too. On to the podcast. So, Dr. Zoreen. I'm going to call you Zoreen.
Call me Zoreen.
Yeah, Zoreen. Okay, Zoreen. It's just the way I always pronounce people's names.
No,
I do it very phonetically.
Yeah, it's the way I blame my parents.
I thought Zoreen, because I've got a friend called Zoreen, and it's Zoreen.
It should really have a double E in it.
Oh, okay, yeah. Fine. Okay, fine. Yeah.
Zoreen. I almost changed it by Depole once.
Oh, really?
People kept calling me Zoreen.
That's like me.
Like a baddie in the Bond movie.
Yeah, yeah. You just sat there with your white cat.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Okay, Zoreen. We're going to be cooking. We're not going to be cooking, actually. We're going to be prepping something very, very simple. It's overnight oats with a chia spice mix, some chia seeds, chai spice mix, some chia seeds. I've already got one prepped from last night, so
wonderful.
Don't worry, not going to have to wait 12 hours for it. And it's going to be chocolate and dried pears. These are kind of unusual. I don't know if you've seen these before, but these are basically halved dried pears. Really really, really good sources of sort of fibre, but they're very, very sweet as well. So it gives that nice sweetness without having to use, you know, coconut sugar or honey or whatever.
Love it.
And I just thought, as you're a working cardiologist and you know what it's like to be as a training cardiologist as well.
Busy.
You're busy and you need to have breakfast sorted. So yeah, I thought I'd do that for you.
Perfect. Sound good? Sounds very exciting.
Great. Okay.
Looking
forward to it. And I've got this trusty scale as well, because like we were saying, I'm really bad at, like, you know, measuring things out. So I'm going to put everything there. Zareen, tell us about yourself, because I mean, the first time we met was after a talk I was on or something,
yes.
And you came up after me afterwards, yes. And you were like, you know, I'm a consultant cardiologist, and I've had a couple of patients that have read your books, and you know, it's been pivotal for them and stuff. And I thought that was so touching for me to hear, but particularly as you're a consultant cardiologist as well, which I massively respect, obviously. So, tell us a bit about yourself. And what you're up to now and how you got here as well.
Yeah, so I've had quite an interesting journey, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
I qualified in 2001, uh-huh. Long, long time ago.
Yeah.
And
not that long, come on.
Yeah, not that long. And, you know, I had a really varied career in medicine. I did loads of things, travelled to loads of different hospitals around the UK, and I think I had a really good foundation in general medicine.
Uh-huh.
And then in about 2005, I decided, actually, I really like cardiology. This is what I want to do.
Yeah.
And then got into cardiology training.
Uh-huh.
Loved it for a very long time.
Yeah.
And then had the opportunity to go to the Royal Brompton Hospital and do a PhD, which involved sleep.
Yeah.
So that is where...
Round the corner from here. Yeah.
That's where my interest in sleep and the role of sleep in cardiac health first came to be.
Yeah.
And then after that, I got a training program up in the Mersey Deanery.
Uh-huh.
So I went up north and completed my cardiology training in Liverpool.
Uh-huh.
And
so
qualified
you lived
in Liverpool
your life for a while.
Yeah, 2017 I qualified.
Oh, wow. Okay, yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, I guess my journey's been quite varied.
Mm-hmm.
And I've had lots of different experiences. And really what I've come to the conclusion of is that over the years, I've seen so many patients, and what I'm noticing now is that they're really getting younger and they're getting sicker.
Yeah.
And there are lots of different reasons, there are lots of different causes, but I honestly believe that one of the main factors is that we have a busy, stressful life, that our modern life lends itself to poor eating habits, poor sleeping habits, stress, not as much physical activity as we should. And then that translates into cardiovascular disease. Mm-hmm. And sadly, what I'm just, you know, seeing in the wards at a younger and younger age. And so I started really reflecting on how I practice medicine. Mm-hmm. And my training is in imaging. And I do a lot of cardiac imaging, mainly ultrasound and cardiac MRI. But now I'm putting a real focus on prevention,
because
I think that's where I can really have a bigger impact.
Yeah, yeah. So tell us a bit more about your training. So you talked about imaging and what you're generally doing, but ultrasonography is sort of the mainstay of what you were doing, or was it?
Both ultrasonography, which is echocardiography. Uh-huh. So for people who don't know what that is, that's effectively ultrasound scanning. So it's what we use in pregnant ladies to look at babies. But instead, we use the same sort of probe and look through the chest wall at the heart, and we can look at the structure, the function, valves.
Mm-hmm.
We can do various things. We can give medications to speed the heart rate up, and we can see what happens when periods of stress.
Mm-hmm.
We can also do ultrasound scans when people swallow the probes. So take a slightly different approach.
Yeah.
So that, yes, all of those ultrasound modalities I do, and cardiac MRI as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I've had a bit of training in cardiac CT,
mm-hmm.
although I don't currently practice that at the moment.
Okay, fine, yeah. So cardiac MRI, I had a cardiac MRI as well.
Did
because,
you?
As you know, I had paroxysmal mitral fibrillation, and that's sort of... You're saying that's how you found out about me, right?
I did, like, I did, because, I mean, we'll probably talk a little bit about my journey, but I was introduced to lifestyle medicine, did a bit of Googling, and I came up against you. Your podcast came up on my iTunes podcast suggestions.
Uh-huh.
And I thought, I'll have a listen to this. And I listened to the introduction where you talk about your journey and atrial fibrillation.
Yeah.
So all of a sudden, all these things kind of really resonated with me as a cardiologist, with seeing, you know, hearing about a young person with atrial fibrillation, of which I see a lot. And the fact that, you know, you went down a very traditional route, which is obviously the route that we all go down and you kind of have to explore. And that you managed to reverse it and keep it at bay with lifestyle measures. I found it amazing. I found it phenomenal. So that is actually, yes, how I first found out about
you. Yeah. And it's a really interesting story, because I think, you know, and I've chatted to a whole bunch of lifestyle medicine advocates, if you like, or not that I think you need to be particularly novel or cavalier these days, for want of a better term, to practice and be a promoter of lifestyle medicine. But everyone seems to have their own personal story when going into here. And, the personal stories can be either yourselves or a family member or someone very close to you, or even patients themselves, or anecdotes and that kind of stuff. Do you have a personal story? Do you have something that changed in your life?
Yeah, I mean, I do have a personal story, and it's interesting that you mention that, because I've noticed that too. I've noticed that whenever I speak to lifestyle medicine practitioners, often they do share their story. And they share their story of, you know, going down a very conventional route, which obviously does work, but for them it hasn't, and they've explored different options, and it's really given them a new lease of life almost.
Absolutely.
And then that's inspired them. And that's a very similar story to me, actually.
Yeah. And you know, sorry, just to say one thing, I don't think it's almost because of the fact that you've shunned conventional medicine, or you've chosen a purely alternative path. I think it's more so that you experience what it's like to be a patient. And that changes your practice forever. You have this new sense of empathy, this new understanding of how embarrassing and powerless it can be to be a patient.
And lonely.
And lonely, absolutely, Sorry, you were about
to
say.
No, that's absolutely fine. And I do want to emphasize that point. I think it's a really important point that we're not shunning conventional medicine. Conventional medicine's amazing. We've made so much progress with procedures, with medications, and that's not what we're saying or promoting. But lifestyle changes always make a difference, and it can be small or it can be large, but it's always worth exploring.
Absolutely.
So I guess my story, I think it started probably after I went back to work after having my son, who's now 5 years old. Prior to that,
he loves a skateboard,
and it's a stunt scooter now. You know, prior to having my son, I was a cardiology registrar. And as you know, it's very busy. We do a lot of shift work. There are a lot of exams. And it really wasn't a problem. You know, I had loads of energy, and I was dedicating a lot of that to my work, and that was fine. However, when I went back after maternity leave, I found that I struggled. And I don't think I realised that I was struggling. I think there's a real mentality that you just get on with it and you cope.
Oh, totally. It's that sort of alpha medic mentality.
Absolutely.
Of like, you know, you're not weak, you can get on with things.
And I had before, you know, I'd been at medical reg for 5 years. You know, I'd done a lot of things, and I thought, you know what? Just cope, Zareen, this is fine. But I was struggling. I was struggling really because the demands of the job are so high. Plus, you know, I'm a mum. I want to spend time with my son. I want to be a good wife. There's so much expectation that you place on yourself. So I slowly started to get what, in retrospect, now I realise were symptoms of burnout. And I mean, it started with, you know, poor sleep. It started with just, you know, stress. I was really stressed a lot of the time and quite unhappy. And then I think it was sort of the middle of 2016, when I was nearing the end of my training, that I started getting symptoms, sort of physical symptoms. And the physical symptoms are actually, it's really interesting, I haven't really talked about, because but I do think it's important that I do mention them, because as you mentioned, it's quite a lonely place. I think that a lot of people, a lot of women, go through the symptoms that I went through and think that they're alone, and that's certainly how I felt as well. So I started getting bleeding, a PV bleeding, mid-cycle. Mm-hmm. So obviously, you know, you think what's wrong, and I went to my GP, and then I got ultrasounds, and I got, you know, they said, oh, you know, there's a polyp, it might be that. And it didn't stop, so I just kept bleeding. Mm. And it started off as a little bit, and then it progressed to a bit more. And then I thought, right, okay, I'm bleeding now a lot. For the majority of the month, I am now bleeding. So I think actually I should take up the offer of having this polyp removed and take it out. And they took it out, and I think for about 4 or 5 days I didn't bleed, and then it started again. And then it got really bad. And I didn't talk about it. I was so ashamed. I was quite embarrassed, which is, sounds really stupid to me now. And it got really bad to the point where I was, I had like this one, what was probably a hemorrhage, whilst trying to put a TOE probe down someone's, transesophageal echo is what I talked about earlier, is effectively a endoscopy. So it's like putting a probe into someone's mouth. And you know, I was quite good at this procedure. So my consultant was standing back looking at me going, why is she struggling? And I, at the same time as trying to put a probe down into someone's mouth, was like, oh my God, I'm having clots. I can feel the clots going down my leg. Yeah. So I just excused myself and ended up going into hospital.
Yeah.
And really, nothing much changed. I was put on medication. They thought, maybe it's an infection, maybe it's, you know, they couldn't find anything pathological per se. And then I just kept on bleeding and I kept on bleeding. And it wasn't, I didn't put two and two together. I didn't think maybe it's because, you know, I'm burnt out. Maybe it's because I just thought there was something physical.
Of course. Yeah. I mean, who would at that point, right? As absolutely. A conventionally trained medic.
Yeah.
That's not something you consider.
And then I thought, okay, I'm finishing my training in early 2017. I'm going to take a break. I don't think I'm ready to start a consultant job. And, you know, I thought about finances. I thought about various bits and pieces, but I thought, no, I'm going to take a month off and then I'll reassess and I'll see what I want to do. And I kept bleeding. At some point I thought, right, I'm going to come off all my medications because it wasn't helping. I was still bleeding. I wasn't sleeping. And then...
And I'm assuming you were on the, you know, the standard medications like mefenamic acid and tranexamic acid and norethisterone.
All of that. Norethisterone, tranexamic acid, mefenamic acid, loads of iron tablets.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
And then I stopped them. And I did still keep on bleeding. But the really interesting thing for me was that the day I stopped bleeding, and no joke, the day I stopped bleeding was the day I finished my training and the day I was gonna have a month off.
Wow.
Yeah. And it really highlighted, and I haven't bled like that again.
And was that the light bulb moment?
And that
for you?
Was the eureka moment for me, that I was really stressed. It was stress. I don't know what it was doing to my hormones. Mm. It was a combination of that and the lack of sleep. I had a really poor diet, although we had started making some changes. And so that month off really allowed me to reflect on what was going on and do a bit of research, figure out how we were going to progress forward, sort of radically changed what we ate, changed how I coped with stress. I started doing mindfulness, yoga. I really did a lot of work on myself. And you know, there's still a lot to do, but I really feel like it was a warning sign for me and a wake up call to realize that I felt really empowered that yes, I had this, but I was in control. I could change it. I could manage it. And that's not always the case.
Yeah, absolutely.
But yeah, it's funny. I've never really spoken about the bleeding, but I did think it's important to speak about it because yeah, it's a lonely place. And absolutely. If anyone else is going through it, then you're not alone. And do seek help. But there are things that you can do as well.
Yeah. I mean, first of all, I think it's super brave of you to talk about these things openly because as I know, as a medic, you have this shield and you don't want to let anyone know about chinks in your armor.
No.
And you don't ever want to demonstrate vulnerability. I think we're getting better at it right now as a sort of profession. And it's because of people like yourself speaking up and saying these sorts of things about and admitting to the fact that, yes, I am stressed and yes, I'm impatient, that we will get better eventually. Mm. But that, honestly, I commend you so much for being open and honest about it, because it is something that we see time and time again. It is something that I see as a general practitioner.
Yeah.
I see it all the time. Mm. And that's not to suggest that, you know, we should be taking people off medication, because they clearly have a role, as they did for you. You know, I still prescribe all these different medications. I still prescribe iron tablets. We still prescribe progesterone tablets when needed. But you know what? Trying to get to the root cause of issues and trying to tentatively figure out what it might be for that person. Mm. In your case, it sounds like it was a catalyst of different features, like poor sleep and stress, and perhaps what you were eating as well. And for different people, it might be different things.
Absolutely.
And it's just about trying to. And that's it's hard to do in medicine, isn't it? Because we're thought this sort of like biological model of medicine, where it's just we have one symptom or one condition, and we have a treatment algorithm for that.
Absolutely.
And we have to think a little bit wider about it.
Yeah.
But that's such a powerful story, and I think a lot of people will be resonating with that.
I hope so. And I hope it makes people appreciate that they're not alone, and that they can get help.
Absolutely.
And that it is something that we do need to talk about and be more open about.
Totally, yeah. I'm doubly glad that you're talking about this, because I'm also ambassador for the Eva Pill, which is a charity that aims to raise awareness of the 5 gynecological cancers. So getting things like bleeding checked, changes in menses, all that kind of stuff, pain having sex, and I think it's a taboo subject, but we're trying to smash the shame around talking about it, because a good friend of mine, Anita Mitra, she's another ambassador for the Eva Pill. She opens up her book talking about a patient who had been consistently bleeding for years before she even saw anyone. And it's because of the embarrassment and the fact that, you know, we as medics also have the same embarrassment around the subject.
Yeah.
It speaks volumes, right? It really does.
It does.
I'm going to get back to this recipe real quick before I forget. So all I've done here is I've put in the chia, the chai spice mix, the oats, the almond milk. This is coconut milk here. And mixed it all together with a bit of cacao powder as well. Mm. Sounds very fancy. Chia is probably the most expensive mix, but really it's just a bit of cacao powder, a bit of nut milk or whatever milk you want to use, and some oats. So you can really, really strip it back to that. Oh, and the dried pears to give the sweetness.
Yeah.
So through the magic of what I've made earlier, this is one that's been essentially soaking overnight for about 12 hours now. So that's got the same ingredients, and we're just going to top it with whatever you want. So I know you like some nuts, so we've got some sliced almonds, we've got some berries here, and then smooth almond butter as well. We're not in school, so we can use nut butters and all the stuff that we want here.
Yeah.
So So what is your sort of like eating habits now? You said that you change your eating habits quite a bit, and what do you tend to eat for breakfast?
And
no shame here, by the way.
Breakfast is often a difficult one, but both my husband and myself, we make a smoothie.
Uh-huh.
Yeah,
nice.
And just put loads of chia seeds, flax seeds, kale, and then a whole load of fruit.
Nice.
We put some nut, I think maybe we put a bit too much.
I mean, I am known to eat this from the jar, to be honest. When I'm at work, people often find me just like with a jar of nut butter like some fruit.
Yeah.
So I probably have too much as well. But
it sets us up for the day.
And then
what I realised was, if I find it hard to eat healthily when I'm on the go. And so when we're organised, we make a big vat of salad with quinoa, parsley, nuts, grated carrots, grated beetroot, chili, garlic, loads of olive oil, loads of lemon, walnuts, pumpkin seeds, anything I've got in my cupboard that can keep. And it keeps. So we make a big vat of that,
nice.
Shove it in the fridge.
Yeah.
and then have that for lunch.
That's immense.
So it fills us up, yeah. And I found that post-lunch dip has gone.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I used to be like reliant on the canteen sort of sandwiches and that kind of stuff in hospital, which we need to address that. But yeah, I used to have that slump and stuff. Yeah. And then when I started eating a lot more fresh and a lot more sort of quality fats and that kind of stuff, I found immeasurable differences in my energy levels. So yeah, try this, give it a try, be honest. So that's spiced pear with overnight oats and chia, some berries and some nuts on top. Super simple, something I have pretty much all the time. In fact, I've got one waiting in the fridge for me.
I want to get some of the pear.
Yeah. You definitely need some of the pear, because otherwise, without, there's no other sweetness in it at all. So you need to get some of that dried pear in it. So it kind of goes with the spiciness and stuff. So nice.
Mm.
You do a very fake there. Very good brother. Good. Well, hopefully you'll be making this and maybe your five-year-old will appreciate it too.
Well, I'm sure he will.
Yeah.
He likes anything with chocolate in it.
Yeah. We'll take a break real quick, but if you want to listen to the rest of our conversation, go over to iTunes or whatever your favorite podcast player is, and then we're going to be chatting about preventative cardiology, your new fresh project, and some other stuff about lifestyle medicine. It's going to be great. So how was your overnight oats?
It was great. I loved it. Really good, yeah.
Good.
I will be experimenting with that at home.
Good, and you can experiment because, you know, there's turmeric spice latte mixtures you can use. You can use ginger, cinnamon, cardamom, clove. Just as long as you've got that sweetness balance and the recipes on the website and stuff. It really makes a difference.
Thank you.
No worries. Anytime. I'm excited to see some of your pictures on social media after having that one. Now you know the recipe.
Yeah.
So let's talk about preventative cardiology. Mm. And, you know, I've personally got a lot more medics asking me where to start and how I started. So we know your personal story. We know sort of what led you to the sort of light bulb moment, the realization that, you know, all these other factors that are holistic certainly have a demonstrable impact, a huge impact on your well-being. So where did you start?
So I started, obviously, I was a practicing doctor at the time. Mm-hmm. I'd gone through this big lifestyle issue and sort of come out the other end and reflected a lot on my own health and how I did things. And then started to look at my patients and how I treated my patients, what I told them, what messages I gave to them. And I was so shocked. I don't think until this point in time I'd really realized how little attention I was paying to prevention over and above, you know, all the usual medications that we give and the prescriptions that we write. And I also realized that a lot of the time when I was seeing patients in clinic, I was popping a bandage on the problem. So they come in, their blood pressure would be high. I'd say that's, you know, it's high. Let's give you a tablet. Mm. And then I'd see them 3 months later and then their blood pressure would be still high. And I'd be thinking, okay, right, let's give you another tablet. And what I realized was that when in cardiology, what we've done over the years is phenomenal. We've achieved so much. The mortality from heart disease has dropped year on year. And yet the prevalence hasn't really dropped. So the number of people with cardiovascular disease hasn't really dropped. And what I was seeing was that my patients were getting younger and they were getting sicker. And whereas, you know, they weren't dying because we've really improved not only our techniques for preventing, you know, cardiovascular disease with statins and those sorts of things, we've also increased the treatment options for people having heart attacks. Initially, we used to just pop people on aspirin and beta blocker and watch them have their heart attack. Yeah. And then there were clot-busting drugs. And now there are techniques where we take people into catheter labs and open up their blocked blood vessels. So these techniques have really made a big difference and stopped people from dying, but we haven't really improved the morbidity aspect. Mm. We're excellent at treating acute disease, but what we lack is really focusing on what happens when it's no longer acute, the moment it becomes chronic. And so not only did I reflect on how I was treating patients in clinic, but I was looking at what I was doing on my coronary care rounds, patients were having, you know, having just had their heart attack, having just had their stent put in, would be on the coronary care unit, and in would, and I'd be prescribing the aspirin and the statin, and in would walk the voluntary service trolley. Yeah. And honestly, I would look at it, and there's not one healthy thing on that trolley. Yeah. There's chocolate cordial crisps, yeah, you know, newspaper, which will probably cause a lot more stress as well. But yeah, at the same time,
I didn't think about the newspaper. Yeah, that's a new angle, actually.
But I really thought there's nothing here that is health promoting. And so it made me really rethink how I was practicing medicine. And then I started to give a lot more advice focused on lifestyle. I started to do that in clinic. That's when I came up against with your podcast. And interestingly enough, I was getting phenomenal results. So people were coming off their blood pressure tablets, and it wasn't big, big changes. It was often just adding a little bit of exercise into their daily routine or changing the times that they ate. It wasn't big changes. And one woman I remember very clearly had atrial fibrillation. And I said, what about listening to this podcast? It's a doctor called Ruby Outler. And why don't you have a read of his book? So she did, and then came back 3 months later. Honestly, she was like a changed woman. She had tears in her eyes. She said, you were like an angel sent from above. And obviously I took all the credit. I said, yes, obviously. Thank you. But that's the credit cool. was due to what you, the advice that you'd given in your book. And I, at that point, really started feeling so good about what I was doing. I wasn't necessarily prescribing medication. I would when it's necessary, but I was giving a lot of lifestyle advice. And so I then realized that I love prevention. I love lifestyle, talking about lifestyle measures. And I started reflecting on what I thought were the key elements of a good lifestyle preventative strategy in patients with cardiac disease, and came up with the Fresh Heart Project.
Fantastic.
Where all the letters of fresh stand for one element or pillar. Mm-hmm. And that's now what I'm focusing on. I still do cardiac imaging, I still see patients, but I'm really now moving towards prevention and lifestyle. Yeah,
that's brilliant. And we're going to talk about the Fresh program that you started in a second. But what I find quite interesting is that even today in conventional cardiology, for want of a better term, I can't really think of something to separate what we mean by lifestyle and how we treat people with just drugs, essentially. But there are more and more investigations and more research trials geared towards pharmaceutical options as a preventative cardiology in itself. So, you know, PCSK9 inhibitors, better and better statin medications, drugs. We really need to reframe what we mean by preventative cardiology, I think, in this country and beyond, because as you said, a typical patient journey is just that. You see a cardiologist or a GP, you put in some drugs, you let them go on their merry way for a few months, and then you come back, you realize that they're at the next step of the treatment algorithm, and we don't even get a chance to talk about that diet and lifestyle stuff because we haven't really had that in our mind. So that's something I think we need to probably reframe our vernacular around quite early. So when you think about preventative cardiology, and we'll talk about the Fresh Heart Project in a second, what do you think of from a pharmaceutical point of view, from an interventional point of view, and from a lifestyle point of view?
Yeah. So I think that we have to take an approach which uses all of those, because we've made so much progress with pharmaceuticals, actually. So I'm definitely not against pharmaceuticals in primary prevention.
And I think that's a really good point, because a lot of people think of statins in particular as the devil, or, you know, no one should be on a statin, which I think is very, it's quite a dangerous play to make, because I'm not just talking about the people with familial hypercholesterolemia who have a genetic condition that renders them more likely to have higher levels of these lipoproteins in their blood. They genuinely are fantastic clinical tools to use alongside all the other tools Absolutely. We have in our toolbox.
And that is exactly it. It's like having a toolbox. And part of your toolkit is medication. Part of your toolkit is, you know, intervention if necessary in certain cases.
Yeah.
But not always.
Yeah. We could talk about the courage trial.
We could talk about the courage trial. And then part of it is lifestyle. And should we talk about the courage trial?
Yeah,
first?
Why don't we talk about that? Yeah, yeah.
So yeah, the courage trial was very interesting actually. So I think, was it 2007? 2007, it was quite a long time ago. And they looked at lots of patients, so about 2,300 patients. And they randomised them, so either to, and these were patients with documented coronary artery disease, and they had to have ischemic symptoms. So what we mean by that is that there are three main blood vessels that supply the muscle of the heart, and in those blood vessels there are significant narrowing, which when tested are significant. Okay, so these are patients with coronary artery disease. That is significant. There are a couple of exceptions. So one is if they'd had, I think, bypass grafts, and one is if they had very, very severe, very proximal, very high up disease in the left main, which is excluded. And that is something that supplies a massive territory and should be treated interventionally. Very uncommon. Mm-hmm. So the majority of patients with stable angina and coronary artery disease, they randomize them either to intervention. So if you, and you know, it makes sense. If you've got a blockage in the artery of your heart, opening up that blockage just from a, you know, from an academic perspective makes sense. If you open up that blockage, you're supplying more blood to that bit of the muscle, and you think, you know, that's going to be beneficial. So in half of the patients, they underwent intervention to open up the blockages. In the other half, they just gave them tablets. So they just gave them medications and said, right, we're going to test this, and they followed them up. And what they found was that actually the end point of major, you know, cardiovascular events and mortality was the same. So the outcomes were the same in both arms. So it didn't matter if the blood vessel was opened up, which really you'd think would help mortality, but it didn't. Tablets worked just as well. What it might have done was help with anginal symptoms a little bit, but actually when you look at the tablet group, anginal symptoms were helped as well. Yeah. So really, intervention and stents in the majority of people with stable angina, and this is not a heart attack, not something where you go into, you know, hospital acutely with, works just, you know, tablets work just as well. Mm-hmm. Okay, it does not save lives. It may help symptoms. And there was an Orbiter trial as well very recently.
I don't know if you've come across that.
This was a group in London, Daryl Francis did. And he said, well, that's all very well, courage is very well, but people who are undergoing intervention, they have had a procedure, so is there a placebo effect with that? We haven't really tested. So they took a smaller group, but about just over 230 patients, and they randomized them to medication, optimal medical therapy, or stents in people who had a blockage in one of their blood vessels. And this was very interesting. They actually found, again, so the group that had just medication actually underwent a procedure. So they genuinely did not know if they had a stent or not, because they had a procedure. They had an angiogram where we look at the arteries of the heart, and they had a little pressure wire or a little wire put down that artery with the blockage. So they had, but they didn't have the stent. So they just had a sham procedure.
Right. Okay.
And then the other group did have the stent. Again, their exercise time was identical.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh my God.
Yeah. And I mean, people genuinely did not know which group they were in.
Yeah, I mean, the first visual reaction is like, how am I sticking that through ethics? First of all, like the sham procedure
It's a good point. And that was really raised at a lot of meetings. But it's a question. It's a genuine clinical question that we have.
Yeah. And I can understand, because if you can demonstrate in the courage trial that medication versus intervention in stable patients, so not acute patients, stable patients, have similar outcomes, then it stands to reason you could potentially argue, well, if we try sham versus the intervention, then maybe we're not putting them at greater harm, as long as they're on medications as well, I'm assuming.
The question from the Courage trial was that, you know, it helps with anginal symptoms. Uh-huh. And the only way in which you can test that it helps with anginal symptoms is to do a randomized controlled trial where they genuinely don't know if they've had a stent or if they haven't had a stent. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it was, there are lots of criticisms, there weren't very many patients, it wasn't followed up for a very long time, but it's very interesting findings, so watch this space.
Yeah.
But intervention in people who are stable generally works just as well as tablets.
Yeah.
And it does not reduce death. It yeah. does not reduce events. And that is the message.
And that's really interesting because I think back then, because of the rationale of essentially putting something in that's going to physically widen your vessels, stands to reason that, you know, it's going to be good
yeah.
for you. And back then it was kind of like the Wild Wild West, right? It's yeah. just like people doing stents all the time. Like, you know, you've got any cut it issues or whatever, we'll just put you through a stent. And that's how it was. But that was really revolutionary at the time.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. And so when we talk about prevention, medications are one element of it. And we do that very well. But what I realized very, you know, recently was that we don't do the lifestyle very well. And Rupi, it's not about blame, which I think is a really important thing to mention. Because often when we talk about diet and lifestyle and exercise, particularly when patients have had a heart attack or if they're in a vulnerable position, it feels like a bit of an attack. Mm. And it feels like we're saying part of this may be your fault.
Exactly.
And that promotes a psychology where they may not be as receptive to what you're trying to say. And they're in a very, very vulnerable position. And I genuinely don't think that we can blame patients because as a society, I think we are more health conscious than before. I mean, how many of us have had a gym membership that we can't go to? How many of us have said we're on a diet or we're being good today? And just not been able to keep that up. And so I don't think it's through want of trying. I think it's actually because the environment that we're in, society that we're in, sets us up for bad, you know, health behaviors. I mean, if you look at the blue zones where people live to 100 really well, they didn't think, oh, I've got to be good today, I've got to go to a gym.
Yeah.
It's just that their environment was set up for health and longevity. And why is it now that at every street corner there's a fast food restaurant, or particularly in deprived areas there are fast food restaurants? Why is it that, you know, you go to a hospital canteen and to get a, you know, bowl of chips is cheaper than a salad or even a banana sometimes? And why is it that, you know, when patients are on the coronary care unit, they're having chocolate yeah. and cordial and crisps wheeled to you? It's just that society has evolved for convenience. We're always on the go and we're sleep deprived.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I feel very strongly about this because I think the default option should always be the one that is in line with our evolutionary design and how we're meant to function. And currently it's one geared more towards consumerism and convenience.
Absolutely.
Which unfortunately don't go hand in hand with health. And the more we see the fact that morbidity is increasing and we have greater prevalence of cardiovascular problems in particular, amongst a whole bunch of other things that we can talk about, it's going to at some point come to a head where we're going to have to actually design new societies and new cities with this in mind, which I'm actually very much looking forward to, because
yes.
I think we can make these changes quite effectively if we plan with the right mindset.
Absolutely.
But that in itself is going to be quite controversial, I guess. And it's going to take a new way of thinking about how we work with industry in particular. Industry has a bad name. But I think there may be some genuine attempts from moral standing people within industry that could change the way health is intertwined with design and how we sell products, essentially. I know that you've taken a lot of inspiration from some cardiologists, in particular from America, who have done sort of lifestyle medicine projects, who have gone through the same sort of training as you. What sort of teachings have you sort of gleaned from them and the research that came out of that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think there are some very inspirational cardiologists in the States. in particular, a couple that I've learned a lot from, Esselstein. I don't think he was a cardiologist. Was he a vascular surgeon?
I don't know, actually. I assumed he was a cardiologist because I remember coming across that paper that everyone's talked about in the past about improvements in luminal narrowing for people with established cardiovascular disease.
And he sort of revolutionized, he paved the way, really, I think. And what he showed was that through just the power of diet, you can reverse coronary artery lesions. Established coronary artery lesions can be reversed through the power of diet. And he used a very plant-based, vegan, very low-fat approach. And his patients complied. He saw phenomenal results. And then there are others. There's Joel Fuhrman, who has also used, he uses a very plant-based approach as well. And he calls it, I think, nutritarian, where, you know, you look at the nutrient content. I think there's something really to be said for that, because if you look at the nutrient, if you maximize on nutrients rather than empty calories, then automatically your diet improves. And he's seen phenomenal results. And then there's also a cardiologist called Dean Ornish, who uses, you know, I mean, he's seen phenomenal results. He's taken people who have established coronary disease and reversed it. He's taken people on heart transplant lists and reversed it. And what he's done is he's used a program of lots of things. So it's not just diet, although that's an integral part. He uses lots of coaching. He uses yoga, meditation. He uses a bit of exercise as well. But then one of the key things that he gives his patients is love and belonging and a safe space in which they can explore the lifestyle changes that they can sustainably make and, you know, to promote their health. And he's been quite an inspiration, I have to say, and the way he goes about it.
Yeah, and I think, you know, one thing that's important to mention is that a lot of the studies have been alongside conventional therapy, right? So some of the studies that showed reversal of cardiovascular disease, of which there are plenty, even though the studies might promote the fact that it was a dietary intervention, it was alongside statin therapy and anti-blood pressure medication. The important thing to note, and there's something that I feel quite strongly about, is I've put plenty of people on statin medications. I've put plenty of people on blood pressure and cardiovascular preventative medications. I have not seen reversal. If anything, it's the other way around. So there is something magical for, again, like something really, really to be taken advantage of and given more attention about the interplay of diet and clinical medications and you know all the other interventions that we have as well. There is something quite special about that relationship, and that's not something to be scoffed at.
And Rupi, you made a very important point in that it is done in conjunction with medical therapy. So if anyone is thinking, oh, I'm going to do this, it's brilliant, please do and explore it for yourself and do what works for you. However, do it in conjunction with your doctor. So if you are on statins, if you are on medication, there is a reason you are, and do it in conjunction with, and that's a much safer way to do it with your GP or your cardiologist or your medical practitioner.
Yeah, even myself, like, you know, I didn't shun medical therapy. You know, I still had my electrophysiology studies. I still had my cardiac MRI that incidentally found the gallstone. Which I've had, I mean, I've ultrasound myself plenty of times. And I don't have a gallstone anymore. Which is quite odd. I had a whole bunch of that. And it was with the blessing of my cardiologist, because they knew that I could still be on my antiarrhythmic medication or beta blockers whenever I needed them, that I could try lifestyle measures. You know, if this was something that was significantly worried about, then I probably wouldn't have gone down that way, because at that point I was a very conventionally minded medic, and you know, the thought of lifestyle, which was introduced by my mother, was just so foreign to me. I was like, I just thought my mum was off a rocker. And now it's kind of like, I told you so. It comes with its own issues. But I think it's a really important point as well. And, you know, that's why I love the fact that you are a consultant cardiologist and you're a big advocate for this. And I see the work that you're doing with the Fresh Project as going to be revolutionary in this country. Because, there's one thing I do want to mention about Dean Ornish, because I'm a massive fan, is that it's currently covered by American medical insurers, right? His program. And that, I think, speaks wonders, because if you can convince a profit-maximizing organization that your program alongside conventional therapy is beneficial and there is data to support that, it's nothing to be scoffed at. It's, that's a huge, huge success for Dean and for lifestyle medicine.
And I think it took him a long time, didn't it? But it makes sense. Prevention is cost-saving.
Yeah, absolutely.
Let's talk about Fresh.
Yes.
I've been dying to talk about Fresh this whole time. So tell us what Fresh is, how you came up with it, and what it stands for, and how you're going to put it into practice.
Yeah. So the Fresh Heart Project came about because I wanted to simplify the lifestyle measures that I think are additional to whatever conventional therapy you're on, just to maximise primary prevention and secondary prevention and the prevention and it's not just about heart disease. It is really about getting the most out of life and living your best life, because if you live by all these pillars and take small steps, then you will feel better. And that's the key. If you feel better, everything else tends to fall into place. And I came up with Fresh because, yes, it is a nice punchy acronym, but it really does incorporate all the things that I believe lead to a healthy lifestyle. So the F stands for food, the R stands for relaxation and stress management, and the E stands for exercise, the S stands for sleep, and then the H stands for happiness.
Very important part.
And if by addressing all these aspects, not all at once, in small steps, you can make real headway in feeling better. And once you start to feel better, you can start to do a little more, and then a little more. And then very slowly, you'll realize that things are falling into place. Symptoms are disappearing. Blood pressure is getting better. And it's a real motivation to carry on. So the way I want people to take the Fresh Heart Project is to take little bits, try it, and use it as a kind of resource for figuring out what's right for them. So I really want it to be an educational experience. B, I want it to be a very personal experience. So I'm running day programs at the moment and talking about all these different aspects. And you know, Rupi, it's been amazing. I've had such really overwhelming response to what I'm talking about. You know, I've had a group of teachers, I've had a group of, you know, retired individuals, I've had lots of different groups. It doesn't matter what age. There are things that I talk about that resonate with everyone, so it doesn't matter what age. And I think what I now want to do going forward is, which I am going to do hopefully starting in September, is pilot more of a coaching program where we take people and coach them through a sort of 6-week program with 10-week sort of intervention arm, where we will see them for 6 weeks very intensively. For the next 4 weeks, we won't see them as intensively, but we'll still touch base. And then we can still touch base for a further few months after that, just to coach them through different lifestyle changes, because behavior is difficult to change.
Hugely difficult. And I will say all the details for that will be on the podcast show notes. So make sure you go to thedoctorskitchen.com and then check out this episode, and all the links to that will be there. So if you do want to go onto this program, it will be there for you. But what I find quite interesting is that there's so many different factors you need to try and put together. How do you even go about trying to address which one is the most appropriate first mover for the patient in front of you? Because I have to do that in an 8-minute consultation. So it's very different. I sort of like have to rely on my sort of clinical skills, acumen, getting a rapport with the patient, and then diving into, okay, what is the one thing, what is the best next step for this person in front of me, rather than putting my own internal biases, which is clearly food, but you know, it might be for that person in front of them relaxation, it might be sleep, it might be, you know, what's the easiest and the most impactful factor. So how do you go about that in your program?
So I will go through them all, and people know.
Okay.
People just know what's missing. Mm-hmm. People then can reflect on themselves, reflect on their lives, reflect on what's missing, reflect on what is the most important for them. So what
sleep.
Is it?
Yeah. It's sleep. It's as you were saying it, I was like, yeah, got that. Yeah, sleep is the biggest. Yeah. It's always
Yeah. Mine as well.
Yeah.
Sleep is difficult.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's the first to go. Whenever I'm stressed, whenever I'm anxious, I don't sleep very well.
You used to be a sleep researcher.
I did. I used to, my PhD looked at patients with obstructive sleep apnea. Uh-huh. And the physiology of blood flow within the heart. And I spent a long time doing sleep studies and seeing patients with obstructive sleep apnea, seeing normal controls. And
do you want to just explain what obstructive sleep apnea is?
Yes. So obstructive sleep apnea is a condition where when you go to sleep at night, your airway maintains patency. It's open. Okay. When you go to sleep, the muscles of your body relax. And in a condition called obstructive sleep apnea, the muscles of the airway also relax as well. So you can actually get an obstruction to air going in and out of the lungs. Okay. So what happens is that the patients with obstructive sleep apnea fall asleep. They start getting more relaxed. The muscles relax. Their airway collapses. They get changes in their bloodstream. So the oxygen goes down, the carbon dioxide goes up, but they don't really wake up. Their brain registers that this is happening. So they then have a big kind of snort where they kind of open their airway and they have a little wakening. But again, it's a little wakening. They don't wake up and they go back into sleep. And then they obstruct again and they have a little wakening. So what happens is that they're having these little wakenings throughout the night and they don't get to deep sleep. So they are missing out on this massive proportion of restorative deep sleep. Plus they're having these obstructive episodes or apneas, which is changing their physiology and causing all sorts of issues, not only cardiac, but you know, metabolic.
Yeah.
And they have an increased risk of cardiovascular disease, in particular hypertension. Mm-hmm. And actually, coming back to atrial fibrillation, which is what you had, which I don't know if all listeners are aware of what atrial fibrillation is. It's a condition where the top of your heart, essentially the top of your heart beats, the bottom of the heart follows. But in atrial fibrillation, what happens is the top of the heart wobbles and then the bottom of the heart follows, but it doesn't have a clear signal. So it follows quite erratically and quite irregularly. And sometimes that can be fast, sometimes that can be slow. Sometimes people don't really realize it, but often it's very symptomatic, especially if it's fast. Mm-hmm. And patients with obstructive sleep apnea have a higher risk of developing atrial fibrillation.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. And I think there's so many issues with poor sleep that extend beyond cardiovascular, but just to think about cardiovascular, and I'm so glad it's obviously part of your lifestyle pillar, because it's just such a huge part, you know, increases or disruption, I should say, to your satiety hormones. So ghrelin and leptin, when that goes up, like, you're more likely to crave the salty sugar foods. You have a disruption to your roaming cytokine levels, so your inflammatory markers are elevated. You have an increased risk of stiffening of your arteries themselves and numinal lowering that, like, is part of the atherosclerotic picture. Blood pressure, like you said, catecholamines, so the actual hormones that drive your blood pressure up. And cortisol, I think, which is A, related to stress, which if you're going to have poor sleep, that's going to be an issue anyway, because you're going to be ratty the next day and everyone's had that. But if you had that persistently over a long period of time, you know, it's one of these really interesting hormones, cortisol, because it's anabolic to fat cells. So it increases your fat cells. But it's also catabolic, so reducing to your muscle cells. You get this, like, it's a really bad picture when you have that in excess. Cortisol is one of the most important hormones. It's not something that we need to get rid of. But it's that balance that's completely out of whack with poor sleep. And that's why you just see this, like, fantastic interplay of all these different things. And using a pharmaceutical model, in my head, you might be like, oh, okay, so cortisol is bad, so let's get a drug for that. And, you know, blood pressure bad, so we'll get a blood pressure medication. And, you know, sleep's an issue, so we'll give them a sedative to increase the... Do you know, that's a very sort of naive, very reductionist way of doing it. Whereas if you can just try and improve their lifestyle, you're naturally going to be improving all these different things at the same time. Yeah. So, you know, this whole notion of lifestyle as medicine, it's true. It's literally medicine is its most truest form.
Yeah. And you've hit on so many important things with sleep. I mean, I was looking at patients with obstructive sleep apnea who have other risks. So they are generally a little bit more overweight. So that comes with its own risks. You know, some of them are, there's a higher prevalence of diabetes, which obviously has more risks. But if you look at just simple sleep deprivation. So if you don't have any sleep disorder, if you sleep for less than 6 hours of a night, then you are also at increased risk. Mm-hmm. And it's through all the mechanisms that you talked about. So the sympathetic nervous system predominates. And when we talk about that, we talk about stress. And, you know, that's when we typically talk about it. Our sympathetic nervous system is evolved so that we can deal with an acute stressor. So, you know, we can run away from that saber-toothed tiger. It's a fight or flight response. And our blood pressure goes up, our heart rate goes up, and, you know, our levels of adrenaline go up. And if you aren't getting enough sleep, then you have that sympathetic nervous system predominance. Mm-hmm. And nowadays, lots of people are wearing monitors and rings, and they can measure things, a thing called heart rate variability. And we find that actually, if you are relaxed and you don't have, and you're not stressed, and your sympathetic nervous system is not on overdrive, then you have a variability in your heart, the time interval between your heartbeats. Mm-hmm. So if you take a breath in, your heart rate tends to speed, and if you take a breath out, your heart rate tends to slow, and that is normal and that is good. But if you have lots of adrenaline circulating, lots of sympathetic nervous system activity, then that goes, and you find that in a lower heart rate variability. So you do have a sympathetic.
So, which is kind of unintuitive, right? Because I'm obsessed with HRV. I have an Oura ring. Not an advert, by the way. I genuinely like this as a tracker because I generally don't, like, I don't wear a watch, I don't wear anything, but I'm fascinated with the quality of my sleep. So when I first came across HRV, I remember thinking, oh, okay, so, like, you know, surely the shorter the HRV, the smaller, the less stress. No, it's the other way around, because you want interbeat variability which is actually a marker of, you know, improved resilience and less stress. So,
The sympathetic nervous system is on overdrive. You mentioned hormones, in particular leptin and ghrelin. Mm. So if your hormones, essentially, if you have a higher level of leptin, you feel fuller. Okay, it's a very, very basic way of looking at it. But your level of leptin is altered if you're sleep deprived and you don't feel full, you feel, and that makes sense, because if you wake up in the morning and you're tired and you're knackered, then you crave food, and you don't crave a bit of broccoli or some kale. What you crave is like that simple carb hit that's going to get your blood sugar up and get your energy levels going. So you crave that donut, you crave that muffin. And so that's another way in which you can just, if you're not getting enough sleep, and, you know, you're perfectly healthy and normal, you can then it leads to adverse behaviours. And then your insulin, you know, you become insulin resistant, and insulin is obviously the hormone that mops up glucose. Mm-hmm. And if you're resistant to this, your blood sugar level can go up, and then you can have a risk of type 2 diabetes. And all of this, as you mentioned, creates inflammation in the body. And inflammation is the hallmark of so many diseases. It's the hallmark of a lot of cardiovascular disease. It's the hallmark of what I see a lot. It's a hallmark of, you know, many, many conditions that are not cardiac, that are inflammatory or autoimmune. Mm. So it getting enough sleep is very important. And our modern life doesn't set us up for that.
Yeah.
You know, we're always on the go. We're always there's something to do, isn't there?
Absolutely.
That can compromise sleep.
Yeah.
You snooze, you lose.
Yeah. And I think it's almost like a societal thing as well. It's a cultural thing. Like, you know, if you are sleeping or you're taking rest, then clearly you're not working hard enough. Yeah. But I think it's a super important topic, which is why I dedicate a whole chapter to it in my book, Eat to Beat Illness, where, you know, eating for inflammation is a very important concept to understand, because it's not inflammation per se, it's the excess of inflammation. Yes. Because inflammation, by virtue of us sitting here and you know, enjoying the fact that we're in the middle of a busy city, you know, it's one of the most protective and most beneficial mechanisms that we have to moderate external and internal stressors, be that pathogenic, so bacteria and virus and all the rest of it, be it psychological, be it from things like sun rays and radiation and all that kind of stuff. But the excess, which is something, like you said, as a hallmark of a whole host of other diseases beyond cardiovascular, it's pretty incredible. And the best, some of the best tools that we have against excess inflammation, one of which is sleep, another which is food, another which is exercise.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing stuff.
Yeah, and stress as well. I don't think we talk about it enough in the cardiology world.
Yeah.
And so that's why I really wanted relaxation and stress reduction to be really a core part of my program, because I am amazed with how many people come in with heart attacks. Now that I'm asking my patients on the ward, I might be a bit biased and I might be getting more of a story.
Yeah, yeah.
But the number of people that come in that say, I was fine, I then had this period of stress and now I'm here, and I'm on a coronary care unit, is phenomenal.
Yeah.
I'll never forget a morning I went into the coronary care unit. It was a Sunday morning and I looked around at the mail bay and I thought, gosh, they're quite young today.
Yeah.
And I talked to them and they didn't really have many risk factors, but the key thing that they spoke about was having this period of stress that then led to this central crushing chest pain that brought them in. And it's so important now for us as a society really to think about how we can tackle this. Because we don't stop.
Yeah.
We don't, you know, we're on the go the whole time.
Yeah.
We don't really incorporate relaxation into our day. Jobs are stressful, home life stressful, there's always something. And it's really important to start the conversation.
Definitely. And there's two things I want to pick up on there. The stress element, I think, is super fascinating, because I think we all know as intuitively as medics that stress has an impact on cardiovascular disease, right? But I don't remember at medical school really being taught that or that being given that much attention, even though anecdotally from patient stories, it's clear like these guys are stressed or these women are stressed and then they're having these cardiovascular instances. And the second thing is this sort of idea that cardiovascular disease is mainly a male problem, but it's actually a huge issue for the female population, particularly postmenopausal as well. So I don't know if that's something that you've seen reflective in your practice. Or...
Yeah, so women are, I don't remember the exact figures, but I think coronary heart disease affects more women than breast cancer.
Yes, absolutely.
And
I think like five or six
times,
yeah.
And I think it's not really recognised. And there's because we don't think about it, we think classically when you're having a heart attack of that male, mid to middle age or a bit older, that comes in with central crushing chest pain, sweaty, and that's still our idea of a heart attack. And as women, we do tend to have slightly different symptoms sometimes. We might have a shooting pain, it might not be on the left side, it might be a funny shoulder ache, and it is difficult to sometimes figure out. But we do need to have a degree of suspicion, and there was a group actually in Leeds that studied this, and they found that yes, if you are female and you come into hospital, then you're much less likely to be diagnosed straight away with a heart attack. And that's both for NSTEMIs and STEMIs. And the important thing here is that time is myocardium, and by that's what we live by as cardiologists. The earlier you can get your blood vessel opened, the better it is for that heart muscle that blood vessel supplies, and the higher chance that will make a good recovery. So it is important that we do start to have a higher index of suspicion for women coming in with chest pain.
Absolutely. I wanted to quickly talk about food. Now, I remember we chatted a bit about like your personal sort of, your personal sway towards food, but you're really open about like food and how it's really about the patient in front of you rather than sort of an agenda towards a particular way of eating.
Absolutely.
Do you mind talking a bit more about that and how that integrates with your Fresh program?
Of course. I believe that it's so important to meet patients where they're at. I think food is so important, which is why the work you're doing is brilliant. And it's really educational. And I, you know, I'm a huge supporter of it. But I think at the end of the day, for a dietary change to be sustainable, it has to align with patient values. If you are a meat eater, then, you know, we need to work with that. If you're a vegan, that's fine. It's all totally acceptable in my eyes. I think what we need to be focusing on are the core tenets. And that is, you know, to optimize the nutrient content of your food. You know, optimize, if what you're eating is nutritionally dense, then you're onto a winner. If what you're eating is a whole food, if you're eating loads of plants, if you're eating loads of fresh fruit, fresh veg, if you're eating the rainbow, as one of your podcasts was all about, and getting all those phytochemicals, all those nutrients in, then already you're creating, and you know, you're optimizing your nutrition and helping to dampen down that inflammation inside your body. I think if you want to eat meat, then if it's from a good source, if it's, you know, pasture raised, grass fed, if it's occasional, then there's, you know, I think that's wonderful. Keep going. Just also optimize the amount of plants you eat. Also optimize your fiber. Fiber is something that we don't talk about that often, and something in our diet, certainly our Western diets, we don't have a lot of, but it has.
I think the conversation is always polarized towards protein, I find. Like, you know, everything's got protein in now, water's got protein in now. It's just like, actually, you know what, guys, we need to really focus on the variety of fiber. And I think that's quite misunderstood by the general public as well, about how fiber isn't just one macronutrient or one part of what we're eating. It's actually hundreds of different types of fibers that you find by eating a largely predominantly plant-focused diet.
Absolutely. Yeah. And we know what's bad. We know that, you know, your processed foods high in sugar are bad. We know that, you know, if you look at a packet and it's got, you know, it's A, illegible, and B, it's got 10 different ingredients, and it's going to have undergone a high degree of processing, which naturally alters that food, which becomes bad for us. We know that trans fats are bad. So we do know what's bad for us. Sugar sweetened beverages, we know what's bad. And so I think focusing on trying to eliminate that and at the same time optimizing your nutrients is key. I also am very well aware of the difficulties in nutritional research, because a lot of data is observational, and it's so hard if you're just looking at populations to say for definite that, you know, this particular diet causes that, because you can't. It's all associations. And there's lots of power in big observational studies, but you still can't 100% assess, say that that diet causes that. And so for that reason, I'm very broad with my approach to food. And I would say eliminate all the bad stuff, concentrate on nutrient content, whole foods, plants, fiber, get your omega-3s in, however that may be, and focus on that. And the other reason I say that is that we don't know a lot about our gut microbiome. We don't know how we handle foods. We're learning. It's the tip of the iceberg.
Exactly. Like this whole picture of what a cardiometabolic gut microbiota looks like, you know, it's very up in the air at the moment, so it's quite hard to determine. But you know, I feel like we could be talking about the different sort of letters of fresh the rest for the whole day. But you know, I really commend your sort of pragmatism when it comes to not only nutrition but also, you know, stress and exercise and all the other features. I can't wait to hear about the sort of stories that are going to be coming out of, and you're taking on patients at the moment, is that right? Through the Fresh program?
I am. I am taking on patients, so please do get in touch.
Sure.
I'm on Twitter and Instagram on @freshheartdoc. I'm sure Rupi will. Do get in touch. Can I talk about happiness?
Please. Yeah, please do. Yeah.
It's one of the things that people often go, happiness.
Why
is a cardiologist talking about happiness? and I really did about including it in my Fresh, but I think actually now it's probably one of the most important because, not to trivialize mental illness, I think if you really And I don't want to do that by putting H, happiness, in there. Mm. Because I strongly believe that if you are undergoing a period of stress, if you do feel that you are depressed or anxious, then seeking help is so important. Yeah. And what I say under happiness may come across as a little bit patronizing, belittling, and I don't want that to feel, I don't want to feel.
Of course.
But it is true that if you are more optimistic, more happier, then you have better outcomes. Yeah. So again, why is a cardiologist talking about it? Well, there are studies to show that if you are, there's one study in particular that looked at, I think it was tens and thousands of older women, and it followed them over 8 years, and it divided them into quartiles, or it divided them into four with how, according to how happy they were. Or how optimistic they were. And they found that the group that was the most optimistic had a 38% lower risk of heart attacks and a 39% lower risk of stroke.
Wow.
Yes. I know.
Wow. Okay.
And I do believe that, you know, happiness, optimism is becoming one of those things that we do need to address. Yeah. There's a wonderful study by Framingham as well. Yeah. So the Framingham risk analysis cohort is wonderful. It's given us so much information. Absolutely. So for people who don't know, Framingham is a town in Massachusetts, and they've followed people up for years and years and years. I think the study started in the 1940s, and they've got hundreds of papers, and they've given us so much data, especially in the cardiovascular world, as to what does confer an increased risk of cardiovascular disease. And the data keeps coming in, and it's ongoing, so it's a great resource. But they published a study in 2008 looking at happiness, and they followed people up over 20 years. And what they found was that happiness spreads. And that sounds really funny, but they proved it. So they mapped happiness, and if you're happy, then you have this sort of hub and spoke almost of people around you that are happy. And if your friend becomes happy, then you're more likely to be happy as well. And that effect spans 3 degrees of separation. So, you know, if you are happy, people around you become happy. If your friendship group or if the people around you are positive, then that is also associated with your own positivity, which then feeds into the whole tenet that if you're optimistic, if you're happy, then you have a lower risk of cardiovascular disease.
Yeah.
And I just think it's so important to talk about barriers to it.
Yes, absolutely.
Because then we can talk about stresses, we can talk, and then everything else sort of falls into place.
Totally. And I'm so glad you brought that up, because I think not to trivialize it, and you can't just sit in front of a patient like, you need to be happier.
Exactly. And, that's so patronizing, you know, isn't it?
I don't care whether, you know, you come from a family where you've been emotionally abused, or you're living on the breadline and you're struggling to figure out where you're going to be sleeping in the next couple of weeks, you know. But there are mechanisms that can improve our resilience to the modern day stresses, psychological stresses, whether that be through meditation, whether it be through breathing, whether it be through, you know, reframing your mindset on a day-to-day basis to think about things, whether it's performing a gratitude exercise. I mean, it was one of the things that I found, like, you know, it put a positive spin on would have otherwise been a stressy day.
Not listening to negative news in the morning.
Exactly.
Do 3 minutes of negative news in the morning makes you more likely to have a negative day.
You know, one of the best things I did was take BBC News off my home screen. Honestly, I used to be, every time you open up a new tab, BBC News straight away. And my word, if it was on now, like hearing about America and all the rest of it, I just wouldn't be able to deal with it. Because it does that, it really reframes your mindset to think of something that is clearly going to be sensational on the news. And there's a lot of negativity around at the moment. Absolutely. But I'm really glad you brought that up, because I think it has a huge, huge impact.
And social isolation as well. I mean, that creates a huge degree of unhappiness. And nowadays, you know, we're neurobiologically hardwired to feed off the energy of other people. That's how we've evolved. That's how we've, you know, we've lived in tribes and we've evolved in tribes. And nowadays we're in our tiny little houses and looking at our screens and not being as interactive. And I think that's having a big impact on our own health and well-being.
This is a bit of a segue, but I recently came across this case study looking at a patient who had a mutation in the FAAH gene, the F-A-A-H, and that gene basically made her perceive pain much, much lower. She was... Yeah, I don't know if there's that movie where you know, where they cut themselves and they hurt themselves and they can't feel pain. Basically, that was her. That was her issue. It was a genuine concern because she, you know, she'd burn herself. She wouldn't realize. You know, pain is a very protective mechanism that we have. She'd lost that. But one of the other things that they found out about her was that her perception of happiness was much higher.
Oh, wow.
So her psychological resilience was a lot higher. So and this kind of speaks into the anecdotes we have about, you know, positive thinking when you go and have your blood taken, or positive breathing when you know, you're going through a stressful event. You know, we are intertwined in so many physiological ways to our psychology. It's nothing to be sneered at. And I'm, again, another very pragmatic inclusion in your fresh project, and I think it's going to be super, super
Thank
impactful.
You. Thank
honestly,
you.
Thank really you. Can't wait. Really yeah. can't wait.
I've got to say it again. I really do commend Dr. Zorin's pragmatic approach to lifestyle medicine and her openness to the different strategies we have to preventing ill health across our NHS healthcare system and beyond. To summarize some of the points that I think are really important, something that she actually brought my attention to, it's looking at the news in the morning and being aware of what impact that has on your stress levels. The connection between happiness and cardiovascular disease, I'm going to link to the studies that she mentioned regarding the Framingham cohort on the podcast notes on thedoctorskitchen.com, so go check them out. The nutrition principles that she really stands by are very similar to the ones that I always advocate. Whole grains, quality fats, largely whole, and lots of plant-based foods. And we also talked about how lifestyle is an adjunct to therapy, so something that we use alongside the current tools we have. And to use lifestyle as a clinical tool, food as a clinical tool, and everything else is really the way forward. You know, we could have talked a lot about decreasing central adiposity and fat cells, improving endothelial function, reducing lipoprotein atherogenicity, postprandial hyperinsulinemia, but really it comes down to the principles that we were talking about. If we can identify people that are at higher risk, perhaps using stratification scores like metabolic syndrome, we can truly reduce the number of heart attacks that we see coming through emergency medicine doors, and something that I see all the time working in emergency medicine. Please do go check out the website for Dr. Zorin. It is lifestylecardiology.com. You can find her on Instagram at freshheartdoc under the same name on Twitter. I really encourage you to go check out her website, sign up for the Fresh Project if you're appropriate as a patient, and you can find all of this information and more at thedoctorskitchen.com. Subscribe to the newsletter for weekly science-based recipes, content, and much more to help you live the healthiest, happiest life. And please give us a 5-star rating if you like this podcast. It really does help spread the message. Tweet us at doctors_kitchen, check out the Instagram and YouTube, and of course don't forget to order a copy of my latest book, Eat to Beat Illness. I will see you next time on the podcast.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.